I'm Mark Simpson, and this is Intersection. It's been a big year in Florida politics. President Barack Obama gets reelected without a Florida cliffhanger. Obamacare becomes the law of the land, leaving Florida Republicans scrambling to implement it. The state enjoys a budget surplus, maybe. Charlie Crist becomes a Democrat, and we're already talking about 2014 elections. 90.7's political commentators Dick Batchelor and Lou Fry are here to wrap up 2012, put a nice bow on it. Plus, I'll wrap up WMFE's series on healthcare, talking to an American journalist stationed in Berlin for an international perspective on the U.S. healthcare system. That's ahead on Intersection. I'm joined by 90.7 political commentators Dick Batchelor, Lou Fry. Dick Batchelor, of course, former Democratic State House Representative, now head of the Dick Batchelor Management Group. Great to have you with us.
Good to be here. Happy holidays.
Happy holidays to you, sir. And, of course, happy holidays to Lou Fry, former Republican congressman, attorney now at Lowndes, Drostick, Duster.
Have a happy new year.
Can we do that, too? Happy new year.
Let's hope 13 is a better year than 12.
Well, before we get to 13, let's talk about 2012. Okay, I want to know, what do you think the biggest story in politics for Florida in the year 2012? Lou Fry, what's your pick?
Well, it has to be the presidential election. I mean, that's the most important election, not only in the U.S., but in the world. And obviously, Florida was in the middle of the gun sight. I think Dick and I both said, please, this time, somebody win it by enough that we don't have hanging chads. And I think we did have an election where Florida did take a little bit of a beating, but not much. There wasn't really any problems with it. There was a problem in the result, as far as I was concerned. But
I thought it was perfectly fine. Well,
I made a speech the other day, and I said I had a bad year last week.
Well, Dick Batchelor, are you going to surprise me, or are you picking the election, too?
No, the election was a big surprise. Parenthetically, the election, I think the big surprise was the president getting 48% of the Cuban vote. Unprecedented. That's a big story. But locally, I have to give you my story. Chris Dorworth, Speaker Designate, gets defeated. That's a big story.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Hey, and if we're looking at, say, the local one, to me, the other big story was the incredible job the Democratic Party did in organizing and turning out the vote, and how in Orange County, they just basically swept into office and with people that weren't unknown and beat good people. These were not people that did. They did a heck of a job of organizing and riding that wave.
Sure, you mentioned that Dorworth race, that kind of an unknown defeat there for Chris Dorworth.
It was. I mean, a candidate ran against him. Keep in mind that he's a former firefighter. They became a lawyer, and the state party tried to get him not to run. The trial lawyers tried to convince him not to run.
Mike Clellan.
Yeah, but it was very unusual for him to get the money in there. Everybody tried to dissuade him, but it was a big surprise. And part of it might have been the sweep, but he's had some Chris Dorworth had more baggage than Samsonite.
Wow, Dick Batchelor, you got me. Well, let's look legislatively, and let's also bring in a bit of a national perspective here, because, of course, the president's health care law has been reaffirmed by the Supreme Court. And, of course, now it's up to the state Republican-controlled legislature to try to implement it in Florida. Lawmakers have to consider whether or not to expand the state's Medicaid program, whether or not to create those online exchanges where insurance can be shopped for. Lou Fry, what do you see as loggerheads looking forward to what the legislature might have to tackle?
Well, the first thing you've got to look at is what's going to happen in Washington and with the fiscal cliff. I mean, that's really going to dictate a lot of what's going to win, because it's not only going to have an incredible impact financially, but psychologically and philosophically it's going to have an impact. So it's really pretty difficult to tell. You tell me what's going to happen on that and what will be thrown into that, and I think I can give you probably a pretty good scenario.
Dick Batchelor, is that part of the calculus you think Tallahassee?
Well, Governor Scott and the Republican leadership, we're not going to do Affordable Care Act. In fact, there's a proposed constitutional amendment. We're going to try to override the Supreme Court. No way. And now there's an epiphany. There's called an election. And now they're beginning to cooperate, and they are holding hearings. There's a Senate committee and a House committee. They're looking at how to implement it. The real key is going to be, though, is the cost. Because Florida could get $20 billion in Medicaid monies over the next 10 years with only having to put in $1.5 billion match. A lot of us, I think, they should do that. The question is whether or not the legislature wants to do that. So the price tag on the Medicaid enrollment increase is going to be the biggest bone of contention.
Lou Fry, what do you think this means, though, for Republican Governor Rick Scott? Previously, he rejected federal funds for big projects like high-speed rail, but here we see for this implementing of Obamacare, he's in a position where he kind of feels obligated to take that money.
Well, the first place, this is the fact that somebody took a position and it's going to be a little different should be a no shock to anyone. I mean, you look at many of the Republicans who were talking about not taxing the rich and have been talking about taxing the rich. So, I mean, you've got that going in there. Secondly, Scott wants to be reelected. And there's a lot of good things in the Obama bill, like, living with your parents or predetermined conditions. Mm-hmm. Many things are there that anybody would, I think, agree to put in. So they're going to cherry pick in terms of that and avoid some of the fiscal things. So I think that it's going to be an interesting session, because the question I have regarding Scott is how much leeway and leverage he has, especially is he going to have opposition in the primary. If he does, he's going to have to act one way. If he doesn't, he can act another way. He's going to have to be really to the right to win the Republican nomination.
And is it too soon to know if he would face challenges within the primary?
Yeah, it's too soon because nobody's announced. But you have three cabinet officers certainly very interested in it, and it really depends where his ratings are going to be. I don't think – is he about 40 now?
He's still about 40%.
Yeah, so they're going to be looking at that and the cost of it. And then you got, of course, the other guy who may turn as a Democrat. He may change, though. He may change as an independent Republican. We don't know what Charlie's going to do. I mean, there's 2 years left of the election. He can
switch
run
back
all
again.
Three of them again.
And, of course, you're referring to the fact that Governor Crist this past weekend came out formally as a Democrat up at the White House. Always interesting to see what Charlie Crist is going to do. How much of a factor do you think he plays in any calculus in terms of what the governor tries to do with health care reform, Dick Matchler?
I'm not sure it has any calculus there, except I think Lou makes a very good point. If the governor's anticipating to have an opponent, he needs to be more conservative in his approach. If he thinks he's going to run a general election where health care is going to be popular, he needs to take another attack on that. But let me say about Charlie Crist, to be very candid, and I've said this before, we don't have a very strong bench in the Democratic Party, you know, as far as candidates running for governor. You know, you've got Senator Dan Rich, who wants to run, current senator, as I mentioned. You got Alex Sink, who ran last time, who wants to run again.
Potentially Buddy Dyer.
Potentially Buddy Dyer. But that's another part of the story, too. The rumor is that Buddy Dyer might be offered something in the Obama administration, which he would probably take in lieu of running for governor. So Charlie Crist, bottom line, is a key factor right now. The irony is he just switched parties this weekend, and he's already the front runner of the Democratic Party.
Yeah, and
bottom line, because he's got name recognition and money.
$3 million at least in this state now to get name recognition, which he has. John Morgan is probably going to be one of his big sponsors, who's close with the administration. And you're going to have to raise a bunch of money to beat Charlie. And we were talking with somebody who said, oh, everybody's going to get angry because he switched parties. I said, look, 6 months from now, people are going to forget who is in what party when. They're going to be mad at the people running the thing because it isn't going to be going well. And Charlie could very well ride that into the governor's race.
Come back to Governor Rick Scott, though, for a moment.
I'm
going to say yes. I'm going to hold you to it, Dick Matchler. Is this an opportunity, dealing with health care, going into this session where Rick Scott has a background in health care, mm-hmm. a unique opportunity to demonstrate some leadership and perhaps use that as some sort of leverage in a future campaign, Dick Matchler?
Well, I'm going to be kind. He does have a background in health care.
And I'll be kind. Furthermore,
and he has a history in healthcare. But yeah, he has knowledge in healthcare, and he could use it to his advantage, because two things are the exchange, whether or not it be a federal mandate exchange and Medicaid. But keep in mind, Affordable Care Act does not, the Supreme Court ruling does not, in fact, it set aside the requirement. The federal government cannot require states to increase their Medicaid rolls. So it really, the full burden falls on the state legislature as to whether or not they're going to take the federal match on that. So I still think that's going to be a pivotal question.
We're talking with 90.7 political commentators Dick Matchler and Lou Frey. Dick Matchler, of course, former Democratic State House representative. Lou Frey, former Republican member of Congress. This is Intersection. I'm Mark Simpson. You can tell us what you thought the biggest story of 2012 is for Florida. Tell us online, Facebook, Twitter, or you can send an email over to intersection@wmfe.org. Talk to me a little bit about Tallahassee, Dick Matchler. Is healthcare going to be the dominant issue in Tallahassee, or do you think there's some sleepers that we're going to hear about coming up?
It's interesting. The Republican leadership, again, they've really changed their tune, for lack of an expression, on the Affordable Care Act by holding hearings now and looking at the impact on that. But also, I think I agree with Lou that education funding is going to be very critical, but it's going to be very, very, very costly too. If, for instance, the university has been raising tuition 15% a year for the last 3 years, approaching a 50% increase in tuition and making it unaffordable for a number of students. And the governor's put pressure on the university system not to raise tuition. So the university system comes back and says, fine, give us $118 million, in lieu of us increasing the tuition. So he's got some Hobson's choices to make, but education funding is going to be a critical issue.
What do you think about this $10,000 degree that Governor Rick Scott unveiled just last week, came over to Valencia College, made a tour of a number of state community colleges, and announcing this degree program? I mean, is that a practical solution? It seems people thought this is just a great announcement, but there's not a lot of execution.
Well, I think it's a good idea if you can actually produce that and give the education for the people for that thing. The trouble is when you first said it, it's sort of like, you know, well, we'll give you a special degree. It's really not a good degree. You can do it for $10,000. Everybody else pays. There's some real problems in it in terms of the degree, what you're going to get, and can you use that degree to go on to other schools and to go on to master's and doctor's programs?
And I think one of the big challenges, too, is the cost. They say now it costs about, $13,000 to produce the student, the FTE. So how do you make up the shortfall of the $3,000, you know, dollars? And the other thing is this whole STEM program where they're really accentuating science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. So the governor is basically saying, look, we should only turn out students who are going to be excelling in these areas because that's what the market demands. Well, I think you got to be careful there. Some people might want a degree in political science. It doesn't have any value. I've got one. Or they might want a degree in anthropology. They might want a degree in sociology. It's not a STEM program, but do you dissuade people from getting a degree in a higher education unless of those areas? Or do you basically come up with a formula, which you're talking about now, is you make the credit hours less expensive for STEM programs, more expensive for other programs like anthropology, sociology, psychology, political science, or whatever?
And I think that opens the doors to an awful lot of jury rigging, who's what's going on and what you're going to do. And I think you might end up spending more of your time trying to decide what program gets what amount of money than teaching kids.
I read an interesting article the other day that proposed that perhaps we shouldn't allow teachers to get degrees initially in education, that maybe you should have a degree in history or anthropology, have some area of specialty before you go into the classroom. And I don't know that that holds traction for the state of Florida going on in the STEM direction, but I just wonder, since we talk about education a lot here, what do you think about that?
Well, you know, there's 65,000 elementary school teachers, and because of the interest we have in civics, Dick and I, and that, and unfortunately, very few of them, and I mean few, have a degree in civics.
Right.
And yet they're charged with teaching our seventh graders about civics, and if they don't pass the test, they don't go to eighth grade. So it is a very real problem in terms of it. And what obviously would be nice would be to see a lot of teachers graduate, at least who've had a course a half a year in civics. That would be, I think, something that would really be good for the state and be good for the teachers and students.
Well, and Lou and I have a great deal of admiration, obviously, for teachers, but I have to add this one point, too. You might be brilliant. You might be working at, you know, Lockheed, and you might be a brilliant PhD in the sciences, but you might not be able to communicate worth a darn. So there's a lot to teaching other than an education degree. You want background in history and all. But then again, you take these teachers with degrees in education, and then they're saying, okay, you're the third grade mathematics, you're going to fifth grade reading, you're going to seventh grade social studies. So they've got to be equipped to do that. So there's a skill set required there, not just being able to produce a PhD.
You started out so good there, saying you were brilliant. I thought you were talking about me.
I stated the obvious.
All right. Dick Batchelor, Lou Fry. Let's look a little bit now. Lou Fry, your favorite neck of the woods there up on Capitol Hill. This 2012 election season, not very far behind us, but we're already seeing a little bit of a shakeup in Florida's congressional delegation, sizing up committee positions. One big one, Representative John Mica, out as chairman of the House Transportation Committee. Maybe Corinne Brown, Dan Webster could back up on that committee. What do you think? Does Florida lose having Mica move on to a committee?
Yeah, of course he does. Yeah. One of the most powerful committees in the Congress. The money goes through there. Sure. But it's a deal the Republicans put together where you can only be chairman, I think, for 6 years or 8 years, and you got to move on. Now, you can move down. You can be maybe
you can still be on the committee.
Maybe. You can be chairman of the Committee on Aviation or Transportation, which John will probably do, and that will be something. I talked to Cliff Stearns just very briefly and talked to him a little bit.
Former congressman
who lost 24 years in it, and I talked to him on the phone. He said, I said, where are you, Cliff? I called him up there. He said, well, I've got the only thing left of my office, and that's a phone. He said, they threw me out of my office a week or so, which is true. Members of Congress, even though they don't terminate till the 3rd of January, he's been thrown out of his office. He has nothing. He has a phone left. So, you know, when you're in, you're in. When you're out. And boy,
way
I'll
out.
Tell you, they don't even remember your name.
That sucker sound you hear is all your good friends disappearing.
well, excuse me, but that really was pretty funny. He was sitting in the geedunk up there talking on his phone, and his office was gone.
Well, talk to me a little bit about what Florida gained from having someone like Micah, who's a hometown politician, on a committee like that when, you know, the earmark policy is gone. So what does Florida gain from that?
Oh, if you're the chairman of a committee, I don't care, earmarks are gone. There's legislation that gets passed, and that you can put a lot of good things in that legislation that are good for the country, but are also good for your state. You're also a lot more aware of the problems as chairman of the committee that you could have. So you have the ability with the big staff to reach out and handle some of these problems. And John, you know, you look in the railroad issue. Look what John does at the Orlando Airport all the time, and a lot of his work down there. So, yeah, it's a big loss. But remember, we don't have a lot of senior people, Republican or Democrat, on the committees in Congress, unfortunately.
But he'll still be the senior member in the leadership there, and he got a lot done. In fact, forget about Sunrail and High Speed Rail and the projects he's worked on. But I remember when he was first elected, there was talk for the longest time to build a new bridge over St. John's River. They talked about it and talked about it and talked about it. John, I think he got that bridge built in under 2 years. I mean, he just said, we're going to build a new bridge. So even though he's no longer chairman, he carries a lot of political currency.
Is there a different committee, Lou Fry, that you could see someone like John Micah going to that would be more powerful than the transportation
committee? But nobody's going to give it up. There have been people in that committee who are moving up, so it's senseless to spend much time worrying about that. John doesn't have anything to negotiate anymore. Yeah. You know, they could have, before he could help these guys with different projects, and now he can, but it's a lot less help. Plus, there's a lot more competition, like for the Commerce Committee, for the Ways and Means Committee, for the Appropriations Committee. There are committees up there that have a lot of people who'd really like to be the chairman.
What do you think in terms of the other members of the Florida delegation, folks like Corinne Brown, Dan Webster, Dick Batzler? What do you think is going to be on their top agenda item representing Florida?
I think, first of all, Congresswoman Corinne Brown, having been on transportation for so many years and chairing the subcommittee on rail, I think, you know, I cannot imagine her not wanting to stay on the committee, particularly with John no longer chairman, because she worked together on a bipartisan way those issues. But Webster, I don't know whether he's interested in like a judiciary or something that like that. But
he's always interested in reforming the practical means of legislating.
Right.
The actual
put him on the rules committee.
Yeah, that is a good spot for him on the rules committee with his background, philosophy, what he's come.
He was a former speaker, senator.
Yep.
Absolutely.
Now, what about Bill Nelson in 2013 going forward? Where do you think Senator Nelson's going to be focusing his attention?
Well, Bill's got to make a decision pretty early on. Is he going to be a national player and maybe be talked about running for president or vice president in 2016 or not? I think he's got to figure out where he's going to be. His committees, as such, he's been on the different committees and the international stuff, and the space committee's not around anymore. So he's got to find some issues. I don't think, my guess is that this is his last six years.
Sure.
And that he's got to figure how he wants to spend those 6 years. And, you know, with Bill, it's hard to tell. Right now, I don't think he knows which way he wants to go.
Dick Batzler, what do you see ahead for Bill Nelson? I think that's interesting what Lou Fry said, possible presidential contender, but his age against him in that role.
I think, you know, he was on a short list before for VP, and I think, and I agree with Lou, he's got to decide if he wants to cultivate that relationship, if he wants to, quote, excuse the expression, but campaign for that position. And that would dictate the committees he needs to be on. What can he deliver Florida? I mean, that's the big issue. Obviously, Rick Scott could not, as governor, deliver Florida, but can Bill Nelson deliver Florida if he's on the ticket? That's a big question.
I want to also ask you guys, in terms of big story 2012, you mentioned the election. There were big, long lines here in the state of Florida because of delays in early voting, just overwhelming outpouring of folks wanting to go and early vote. There's five underperforming counties being looked at right now in South Florida, and the state has put together some investigation into looking at what actually happened. Lou Fry, do you mark that up as still Florida facing big election problems, or do you think—
I don't think they're big election problems, but any election problem is a big election problem, and especially in Florida where the problem get really blown up. I think they did a pretty good job this time, but not good enough. They got 3 years to work on this thing and get it together. let's go find a state where there were no problems, look at what they do, and steal the ideas from them.
Well, I mentioned earlier there's Senate leadership in the House, both obviously Republican leadership in Tallahassee have had an epiphany. They're talking about Affordable Care Act, but they're also talking about election reform. They've already started hearings on election reform. They're already talking about ethics reform and doing away with campaign committees.
This is coming from the
Republican leadership of the House and Senate. I mean, these are issues that they begin to sound like Democrats. One of the things Republicans have to really handle carefully, and I don't know how they handle it, and getting back to the governor too, is the Tea Party. You know, remember when he was first elected, he swearing in was Tea Party oriented. He introduced his first budget at the Villages. It was a Tea Party thing. Signed his budget at the Villages. So is the Tea Party really significant anymore? Are some of the Republicans beginning to say, I need to walk back from that?
Yeah, and that's just not an issue for Florida. That's an issue both locally and nationally. It's probably one of the key philosophical fights we're going to have in the next few years.
What's your biggest story, do you think, looking ahead to the new year, 2013? What do you say, Lou Frey?
Biggest story is going to be fiscal responsibility. Are we going to get any, or are we going to go down the tubes?
What do you say, Dick Batchelor? What do you see in your crystal ball?
I see people being pushed off the fiscal cliff.
Let's hope there's a net underneath
not,
for them.
Not for some. But I agree, the economy, getting the economy squared away, getting the confidence in the market, people are being employed, and you have to work your way out of a depression, and then jobs creation has got to be at the top of the list.
We've been speaking with 90.7 political commentators Dick Batchelor and Lou Frey. Dick Batchelor, of course, former Democratic State House Representative, founder of the Dick Batchelor Management Group, and Lou Frey, former Republican Congressman, attorney now at Lowndes, Drostick, Duster, Kanner, and Reed. Nice to see you both, gentlemen, and Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year.
Thank you.
May 13 be better than 9, 10, 11, and 12.
I hope 13 was just as good as 2012 politically.
Up next, healthcare reform from an international perspective. Understanding healthcare reform can be complicated. Sometimes perspectives from far away have a different view of things. That's why we turn now to the German capital, Berlin. There, the term universal health coverage means something very different than in the United States. Here to walk us through a German perspective on healthcare and compare it with reforms happening in America is reporter Yuna Lee. She's formerly of the collaborative Healthy State Florida Project, and she's currently a Fulbright journalist in Berlin. She spoke with 90.7's Tom Parkinson via Skype about the topic.
Now, Yuna, that term universal coverage here in the U.S., especially in political circles, can imply a number of various things. But in Germany, the healthcare system evolved under different circumstances. Kind of walk us through that, if you would. How did the current German healthcare model come about?
Sure. So it all started with Prussian Chancellor Otto von Bismarck in the 1880s. He's really the one who invented the healthcare system with his health insurance bill in 1883. And that program provided healthcare for a lot of German workers. And today, because of Bismarck, you see roughly the same system where costs are divided between employers and employees. There's universal coverage in Germany, as you mentioned, where most health necessities are covered. And this includes optical, dental, and mental care even. The system also supports alternative therapies like yoga and acupuncture if its benefits are supported by a clinical trial. So there's evidence-based medicine here. But I should also add that it's mandatory in Germany to enroll in health insurance. So this also affects physicians as well. I spoke to German physician Henning Adam, who worked as a neurology resident in Frankfurt. And this is what he likes about the German healthcare system.
You can help everybody in the first place, you know. If someone comes to the hospital, I really don't have to think about, is he covered, is he not covered, because he surely will be. So I can concentrate on treating the patient and doing what's best for him in the emergency situation.
So Adam thinks that the U.S.'s biggest problem is that its healthcare system doesn't cover everybody and everything.
Well, that's interesting. In Germany, you know, the healthcare system, it isn't a giant monolith. I mean, there are also different types of sickness funds that people can join based on their income. Are those kind of like our U.S. insurance health plans and how they work?
There are two main systems, the public and the private. The majority of Germans, around 90%, are in the public system, and they can choose among 150 insurers. And those are called sickness funds in German. So then Germans then pay premiums based on income to one of these funds. And just to clarify, it's called public because it uses public money, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it's regulated by the government. And then on the other hand, the private system looks a lot like the US's. First of all, you need to make a certain amount of income before the private option is available to you. But Germans pay a risk-related premium like in the US. And in this system, insurers don't have contracts with providers. Instead, patients go directly to doctors, get the bill, and then the reimbursement from the insurer.
How do people like it? You know, what do the patients, the people using the German healthcare system, think about healthcare in America?
I had the opportunity to speak to one of the patients here. So I spoke to Hiso Dag, and he's originally from the southeastern part of Turkey and has lived in Germany for 7 years. He had back surgery a year ago, and believe it or not, he only paid 70 to 80 euros for the whole thing. The surgery was covered by insurance, and he paid 10 euros for each night that he spent at the hospital. So he paid 70 to 80 euros total, meaning he spent 7 to 8 days in the hospital. He couldn't remember which. So Dad said something interesting. All things considered, he would rather be treated in Germany if he were in a car accident. But if costs were an issue, he would want to be treated in the U.S., actually, because he thinks the U.S. has really good quality of care and less bureaucracy. So when I asked him about costs in the U.S. then, he said he definitely wouldn't be able to afford the possible $60,000 bill in the U.S. for the same back surgery. This is him when I asked him how he would pay for it.
I don't know. It's really hard. I don't know. If you don't have a work, or maybe I wouldn't do that, you know.
So what Hiso was trying to say was that he would have lived with his back problem instead of seeking out medical care if he were in the U.S. So many Germans can't understand how this can happen in the U.S. For them, paying such a bill is unthinkable, and they don't understand how some Americans are not covered, especially since the U.S. has the most expensive healthcare system in the world. So according to data by the OECD, which stands for the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the U.S. spends about 17.4% of its GDP on healthcare, while Germany spends only about 11.6% of its GDP. And the Germans still outlive Americans by 2 years.
So, Yuna, you have an unusual perspective here, having covered health care here in Florida and now covering health care in Germany. Are you able to say that one model is more effective than the other?
Well, it's hard to say whether one model is more effective. I would just say that the two systems are just different. I spoke with Reinhard Busse. He's a professor of healthcare management at the Technical University of Berlin. And this is what he said regarding the U.S. healthcare system.
We don't see the system. I mean, it's a very fragmented system overall. There are many other parts of the population which are left out. And for us, it's always difficult to understand why a society would tolerate that.
He also thinks the U.S. will have a hard time enforcing the individual mandate. He told me that he thinks many of the currently uninsured will just pay the $95 penalty.
Well, that's interesting, Yuna, and really appreciate all your reporting over there in Germany. And thanks for taking the time to talk to us.
My pleasure, Tom.
That's Fulbright journalist Yuna Lee, based in Berlin. She was also a Healthy State Florida reporter based in Orlando, speaking with 90.7's Tom Parkinson. The conversation about what's happening in Florida continues online. You can visit WMFE.org/intersection to find out more. There you can also sign up for our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Amy Green is assistant producer. I'm Mark Simpson, and thanks for listening.